This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Yesterday's New York Times featured a story on an apparent enormous shift in public opinion in one congressional district in Minnesota. A poll in September showed the Democratic candidate up by 1 point, while a poll this month put the Republican ahead by 15 points. The situation brings into sharp relief the challenges of conducting accurate polls in some states or even some districts.
Questions about polls are on the minds of our Informed Voter Texting Club as well. It's our pre-election collaboration with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And for this edition, we're joined via Skype by the Journal Sentinel's Washington Bureau Chief, Craig Gilbert, and by Charles Franklin, who directs the Marquette Law School poll. Welcome to you both.
It's nice to be with you.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So we've got a number of questions from our Informed Voter Texting Club about the way polling happens and how we should understand the reporting on polling. I'm going to start with one for you, Charles, that I suspect you get a lot. This is a question from Rich in Milwaukee, who wants to know, what determines the mix of Democrats, Republicans, and independents in the polls? What are the factors that go into choosing who gets to participate?
The answer is random chance. We don't say ahead of time what percentage Dems, Reps, and Independents there should be, because we have no way of knowing that. We don't have registration by party in the state, so you couldn't go to the voter registration list and find that out. Literally, the only way to know that party balance is by asking people. And so the way our poll and almost all media polls work is by beginning with a random sample that gives every phone number in the state, whether it's a landline or a cell phone, an equal chance to be sampled, to be phoned and interviewed. And it's out of that random sampling that people tell us the answer to the question, generally speaking, do you usually think of yourself as a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? And it's the answer to those questions from our random sample that determines the party balance, the percentages in each party within any given monthly poll. So that's how it's done. It's not that we know ahead of time, because there is no way to know ahead of time.
Do you need a critical mass of each of those groups to say you're done with the polling? If you polled, 1,000 random people and got 900 Democrats or 900 Republicans, would you keep calling until you got enough of the other party to get a significant sample?
Well, if that happened, there would be something very seriously wrong with the poll. But the answer is basically no. We draw a set of random phone numbers to dial, and we keep dialing until we've reached the 800 people that we want for a given sample. Or right now, we did 1,000 in the October poll, a little bigger as we get closer to the election. But essentially, what you do is you call those numbers. You keep calling them back if you don't get an answer. And then when you reach the 800 sample size, you stop. And there's no other criterion like party balance or anything else that determines when you stop. Again, we're relying on the laws of probability to give us a stable sample. But that stable sample is always within the margin of error for the sample size. So the bigger the sample, the smaller the margin of error. But typically, our margins of error are between 3 and 4 percentage points.
And I'm glad you brought up margin of error, because we got another question. It's a fairly long one from Diane in Milwaukee. And I think this is really a question for both Charles and Craig here. Results of the Marquette poll are always reported by you in the Journal Sentinel. She's referring to us at WWM. She would like to know more about the margin of error. And I guess, the question that jumps out at me is, well, I'll just keep reading this question, and maybe we'll start with Craig here. How does margin of error affect interpretation of polls such as the Marquette poll? She says, does a 5-point lead really mean, say, Tony Evers is ahead, or are the results within the margin of error as the media use?
Well, all it means really is that the tighter the poll is, the more conservative I think we need to be about describing, about characterizing the state of the race. If Tony Evers is ahead by 5, that's not meaningless. It doesn't mean that Scott Walker could just as easily be ahead by five if the margin of error is five, but it means that it's not as solid a number as if you were ahead by eight or nine or 10. So you can get lost in the weeds of margin of error and how it works, but I think the basic rule for us is the tighter the race, the more cautious we should be about characterizing who may be ahead or who may be behind. But if a lead is within the margin of error, it doesn't make it meaningless either.
And so, Charles Franklin, how do you establish what the margin of error is?
First of all, Craig's description is actually very close to the way we think of it as well. The margin of error is a mathematical formula. It's the design effect times 1 over the square root of the sample size. I did that on purpose just as a little bit of a joke. But that is, in fact, the formula for it. But in this particular question, the point I think is a good one, and that is if someone's ahead by 1 or ahead by 5 and the margin of error is, let's just say, 4, how should you interpret those two things? Well, if you're ahead by 5 and the margin's 4, then the odds are pretty good that you're actually ahead. If you're ahead by 1 and the margin is 4, well, the odds are still a little bit that you're ahead, but they're not nearly as likely that you're ahead as if you were up by 4. One way we deal with it, and I'm going to actually read it to you, is the way we describe the results. So this is from our latest release. A new Marquette Law School poll of Wisconsin voters finds incumbent Republican Scott Walker with 47% support and Democratic gubernatorial challenger Tony Evers with 46% support. We didn't characterize that as a lead or not. We just gave you the numbers. And in general, that's what we do. We try not to characterize it. Now, in the Senate race, where Baldwin is 10 points ahead, that's more than twice the margin of error. And so there we would be statistically justified, and in fact we say in the release, Tammy Baldwin leads among likely voters with 53%, while 43% support Republican challenger Leah Vukmir. So that's the kind of distinction. As a rule of thumb, if the margin is twice the margin of error, then you're justified in saying someone has a lead. If the margin of error is about equal to the lead, then that person is probably ahead, but not to a statistical level of certainty. And finally, if it's less than the margin of error, you should be pretty cautious about saying one is ahead of the other, which is why we simply report the percentages for each candidate, but try not to characterize it as a lead or ahead. And in this case, I described it as pretty clear evidence that we have a very close, highly competitive race.
Craig Gilbert, does that kind of square with how the Journal Sentinel describes the results of a poll?
Yeah. And I think, again, the important thing is to be a little cautious and conservative about taking the numbers in a poll literally. And so, yeah, I mean, if you have a race where every poll keeps finding that one candidate is 4 or 5 points ahead, then I think you can be, you know, more confident about describing the state of the race. But if it's bouncing around a lot within a small margin, then, you know, that's a different story. So I think you want to kind of base your characterization of the state of play on as much information as possible, which includes also, you know, obviously different polls, different sources of information, the way the political players in a race are behaving tells you a lot about the state of the race. You sort of, I think, want to rely on all the signs and all the signals if you're going to, with any confidence, characterize whether someone is winning or losing a race.
And quite obviously, I mean, you don't just cover the Marquette Law School poll. There are many polls that are out there. But let me ask both of you, is there a general rule of thumb for what the margin of error should be for us to think of something as a legitimate poll?
Charles, you want to take that?
Well, again, the margin of error is a mathematical formula. It's not really a judgment call. Very few polls will come out with sample sizes below 400 or even 500. And so the margin of errors will be typically somewhere between 4 or 4.5% and maybe as low as 3%. But there are very few polls released to the public that are margins of error much more than five or so. Sometimes we will do a half sample question with just half the number of respondents on a policy issue we'd like to know something about. But we would not do that with things like the vote choice, which is always full sample.
I think what the question is getting at more broadly is how do we decide, how does a voter decide or a reader or a journalist decide which polls they think are credible and which polls they think aren't credible? And it really, you know, as a journalist, you don't want to be a gatekeeper and just you know, be the referee who's saying, I'm going to report about this poll, but I'm not going to report about these other three polls. At the same time, you do have to make some judgments because some polls are really bad and some polls are very respectable. And so a lot goes into those judgments. It's not just margin of error. It's not just sample size. It's kind of looking at the totality of the poll. But it's a real balancing act for journalists, I think, because, you know, we're not, you know, kind of the omniscient, all-knowing force that can tell the difference between a good poll and a bad poll. But you have to bring some judgments to bear. We don't report on all polls equally. I mean, one reason why we report on the Marquette poll generally more than other polls is that they have a very long history of polling and they're totally transparent. So you can actually go in and see how they do the poll and there's no mystery about it. Whereas some polls, there's kind of a secret sauce where you don't know how they're weighting, you don't know what assumptions they're building into the polls. And so that goes into your judgments about how much attention to pay to a particular poll.
Well, and let me throw a question in here to this. I don't know if other people have this on their mind, but let's say you're at home and you get a phone call from someone purporting to be taking a poll. How would you assess the legitimacy of that poll?
The person who's getting the phone call obviously often doesn't know who's doing the poll. I often, if I'm getting that phone call, I will ask, and you may or may not get an answer, but you're not going to know. I mean, you're not going to know, A, you're not necessarily going to know who's doing the poll. You're not going to know necessarily how it's being used. And you're certainly not going to know from being a respondent, you know, what the methodology is behind that poll. A lot of the polls you might get on your phone are not polls like Marquette. They're not public polls or not independent polls. They are campaign polls or they're interest group polls. In some cases, they may be push polls, which are designed to kind of influence your perception of a race, not to get your opinion. So it's tough when you're at the receiving end of a phone call to make those judgments.
I think that's right. And unfortunately, I don't know what the answer to it is. For the Marquette poll, the first thing we say is I'm calling on behalf of Marquette University. And so we identify ourselves right at the beginning. Most media polls do the same thing. But campaign polls, for understandable reasons, don't do that because it would influence people's responses if they knew they were being polled by the Evers campaign or by the Walker campaign. So those kinds of polls are very reluctant to identify themselves, especially at the beginning of an interview. They are supposed to answer your questions about who they are, but if they do, they'll typically terminate the interview because of this problem of knowing who the source is influencing you. Happily for the Marquette poll, we're not in that position, and the transparency that includes releasing all of our information about how we do it also includes telling people up front who we are and what we're calling about.
We have just a couple other questions from listeners. One is from Lynn in Milwaukee, who wants to know how you can get an accurate representation of opinions when so many people don't have landlines, have unlisted numbers, screen calls, or block numbers.
Well, the first thing is that 60% of our interviews are on cell phones. And so we're already calling the same percentage of cell phones as are cell only in the state. So that's not actually an issue anymore. The call screening is probably the biggest issue with telemarketing explosions and illegal calls to cell numbers by telemarketing scams. Response rates are lower. The saving grace from my point of view is that Democrats and Republicans are completely united in hating scam phone calls. And so as a result, we don't get a partisan bias because of people being reluctant to answer. But there is an issue of 80 to 90% of our calls go unanswered, some because people are not at home, but some because of call screening. There's just simply nothing we can do about that.
Has your approach, either of you, to analyzing poll data changed at all since 2016 and some of the challenges in the presidential race?
Well, I would say in my case, again, I think I try to bring a lot of caution. I mean, to me, again, and also obviously because, you know, when you have a surprise result, quote, surprise, unquote, like we had with Trump's election in 2016, that's a little humbling. And so it's just another reminder that you can't be certain about, A, not only what's going to happen in the future, but sort of what the state of the race is. And so you just want to satisfy yourself that you have as much information as possible before you draw any conclusions about the way things look. And that's, again, that's relying on as much data as possible. It's, you know, you never should sort of build a whole narrative around one poll in isolation or one number in one poll in isolation. So just be mindful of the limits of polling and the limits of the numbers and look for patterns and trends that you find are replicated over time or in more than one poll, and just bring a little humility to the subject.
I agree with all of that. And I think those of us, including me, who got 2016 wrong, we had Clinton up by 6 in our final poll here in Wisconsin. It's certainly a vivid reminder that polls can be wrong. And I think that's a valuable lesson to the public as well as to the pollsters, that we do our best to get the most accurate responses we can, but we're fallible too, and those things can go wrong. I also want to point one other thing out. Almost everything we've talked about is about the horse race,
right?
The who's ahead, who's going to win. That occupies, in our last poll, 6 questions out of 40 that we asked about public affairs here in the state. And yet the horse race is the thing that gets the vast majority of coverage. And I would just point to 2 simple findings in our last poll. One was that nearly 60% of the public said they were willing to pay higher taxes for schools, and 61% said they were not willing to pay higher taxes for roads. I think that has some relevance to the campaign and arguably to the problems of the state's management and the complications that politicians have in delivering the things the public wants. And maybe it would be nice if we paid a little more attention to some of those kinds of issues instead of focusing only on the horse race. That said, there's a reason you have horse races, and that's because people are really interested in what the outcome is. So I get that. But I do think that the policy side of polling doesn't get nearly the attention that I wish it did.
Yeah, and I would echo that and just say, you know, the other dimension, which is really interesting to me about polling beyond the horse race, Charles talked about the policy dimension, but also, I mean, to me, the most interesting numbers in the polls are usually not the horse race numbers, but sort of what it tells you about, you know, the electorate, what it tells you about, you know, kind of division, the nature of divisions in our electorate, what it tells you about trends in public opinion, what it tells you about our political culture. There's a lot of information in these polls beyond just a horse race that is actually a lot more interesting than whether somebody's up or down by 3 or 4 points at a given moment in time. And that's, you know, it's invaluable to have that kind of data. I mean, we're lucky in Wisconsin that we have a poll that's been done so often, you know, so consistently for a long period of time that there's a wealth of information there. And I think that's information that's generally of high interest, in some cases, just as high interest to readers as the horse race numbers.
I will echo that and say we are lucky to have you both.
Thank you much.
Great to be with you.
Thank you so much, Craig Gilbert and Charles Franklin.
Charles Franklin is director of the Marquette Law School Poll. Craig Gilbert is Washington Bureau Chief for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. They joined us as part of Informed Voter Project, a co-production of WUWM and the Journal Sentinel. You can learn how to participate in future segments at WUWM.com.